From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Peter Guralnick returns to the show this week. He's the author of the 2-volume definitive biography of Elvis Presley, as well as many other books of history and fiction, including biographies of Sam Cooke, Sam Phillips, and his latest book, The Colonel and the King, Tom Parker, Elvis Presley, and the Partnership That Rocked the World. Peter Guralnick, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It is always good to be back, and I'm just glad that you're having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. So this new book, it's a collection of Tom Parker's letters with just a short 300-page preface by you.
That's right. You know, I said, and I don't know if I said it on your show, but that after Sam Phillips, I would never write another biography because it's total immersion. And it's not that I planned on hanging up my spikes or anything like that, but, you know, I just thought, okay, enough is enough. I've done this now for, at that point, it was almost 40 years, starting with Elvis in 86. My only exception was going to be if Merle Haggard called, you know, just out of the blue, and he said, you know, Pete, I've been reading some of the stuff you're writing, and, you know, it's not bad. I think maybe we could do something together. And it would have, I mean, I dreaded it, but I knew it would never happen, but at the same time, it never did happen. But here the Colonel is, and he tricked me into writing this sort of, I like to call it a biographical portrait. It's not a full biography. It's only 300 pages, but that just goes to show the power of Colonel.
He snowed you into writing it.
He snowed me, and the book was going to be letters originally, and for a variety of reasons, despite the fact that Jack Soden and I had worked it out that we would publish that book back around 2000, 2001, a number of factors interceded, including the sale of the estate by Lisa Marie. And then in the intervening time, so it's been 30 years, but in the intervening time, I found a number of sources, but primarily, as I was beginning the book of letters, Colonel's widow, Loanne, his second wife, a wonderful person, really a genuinely kind and a wonderful person, she got in touch with me. I'd known her about 10 years, but I really didn't know her well at all. And she said, is there any way I can help on this book of letters? And I said, well, sure, because, you know, you never turn down help. Colonel might have turned down help. How much does it cost if it's free was his mantra. But, you know, I just figured, okay, sure, I don't know what it could work. And as it turned out, the help was truly extraordinary and sent me off on a whole other journey because what she provided, I mean, she loved the Colonel dearly. She loved him, and she admired Colonel as much as she loved him. But she felt that he deserved his place in history, and he deserved the truth, and she was committed to telling the truth. So she told me all these things, stories that he had told her, which I couldn't use literally in most cases because, as she said, he told the same stories so often. He loved certain stories growing up in Holland, which she didn't even know he was Dutch for many years after they first met. Yeah. But, and so she would remember as best she could the stories that he had told her, like being a prepubescent opera singer in his hometown in Holland. I mean, where else, you know, so, but that really set, and she also told me things that I would never have sought to find out because I wouldn't have thought that you can't ask people insulting questions. And I honestly never thought that Colonel was, let's say, a gambling addict and would not ask that question of anybody. I mean, it's a direct assault question. But, and yet she talked about his gambling addiction in a way that it must have been so difficult for her to say this. And yet she was committed to the truth. But in the course of this, I felt compelled to seek out other people who were not necessarily recorded in history. I had interviewed so many people in writing the Elvis book, and I relied on many of those interviews. I knew Al DeVorn, for example, the voice that said Elvis has left the building and went back with Colonel to 1950 or 51. So it wasn't that I was starting from scratch, but then I discovered all these extended families that Colonel had developed from the time he was first stationed in Hawaii in 1930 when he was in the army. And met the Kufrath family, a mixed German-Japanese family with whom he remained friends till the end, to the end of his life. And these things were a total surprise. So where I thought the letters would be a way in, I'm really sorry that this is such a long-winded way around the barn, but I, you know, I saw the letters as a way in. The letters were a revelation to me when I was given the opportunity to get into the archives by Jack Soden in 1995. But because they revealed a completely different person than the person I had come to know over the last 8 or 9 years and then had been portrayed. I mean, not completely different, but so much more depth, so much more humor, so much more vulnerability, so much more sensitivity, and most of all, so much more detail. And then that just made me feel, okay, that's the way into to the, you know, to the backstory, to what isn't readily perceivable by the public at large. Or, and then all these people who whom I spoke to, whom had loving relationships with Colonel, but relationships who were completely off the book. I mean, they just were unknown. And they Colonel left Holland when he was 16. He left his family and he formed all these family associations from that time on. And none of these extended families necessarily knew each other, but they were all close to Colonel and they all developed relationships with him. And he developed relationships with them, which were close and loving.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say revelation about things about Colonel Parker, since you wrote, you know, I don't know how many pages, you know, 1,000 pages about Elvis Presley, to suddenly have revelations about the Colonel. And I think a lot of people kind of consider the Colonel to be the villain in the Elvis Presley story. And I think, I don't know, do you think that Last Train and Careless Love, your two books about Elvis, contributed to that feeling?
I don't think so. Not really. And I guess I'll explain how the letters provided a revelation or provided me with a deeper and more extensive portrait of Colonel. But I will say that in Last Train, in the first edition, and I haven't gone back to prove this, and you may have readers out there who are much more perspicacious than I. That's like, but I think in Last Train, I know I did a disservice to Vernon Presley and in the first edition, in the original edition. And I changed that to the extent that I could while retaining, you have to retain in rewrites, at least in the old days when books were books, physical books, you had to retain the pagination. So I did rewrite the passages about Elvis's about Vernon to a considerable extent. That's it. That's the original. And I did to a less extent with Colonel, but by the time I wrote Careless Love, which came out in 99, this is the Last Train came out in 94. By the time of I had a different and much fuller view of Colonel Parker. But what I didn't have was a sense of his inner workings. And I didn't think, I honestly thought, and this is Jack Soden describes Colonel Parker, whom he very much respected and had a long a congenial relationship with. But he describes him as a lovable rascal, a lovable rascalian. And if you look at the portrait of Colonel Parker in Careless Love, it's really a picture of a kind of Falstaffian figure, somebody who through his humor, his energy, he's the engine that keeps the story going. He's the engine that provides both commentary. Last Train to Memphis told itself. The external story of Elvis's rise to success is unimaginable. It's something which you couldn't make up. And if you follow the externals, you obviously have to make a selection. That is the skeleton of the story. In Careless Love, which starts with essentially with Elvis's mother's death in 58 and Elvis being in the army and goes through till Elvis's death, the externals don't matter as much because it really doesn't make a lot of difference whether Elvis is making clam bake or, you know, some other roast about those things. That isn't the story. And what Colonel is doing, his exploits, his, the deals that he makes, his mind always churning, is sort of what keeps the story going. And then you come back to Elvis and both his huge, very high aspirations. I mean, some of the most beautiful music that he ever recorded occurred after he came back from the Army entirely by deliberation in the early 60s. But Colonel as this Boston, I saw him as a character and put quotes around it. And if you look at the picture that I drew, a portrait that I drew in Looking to Get Lost, my last book, and it's again, it's the story of my relationship with him. I'm not saying it was a very real relationship to me. It wasn't a major relationship in Colonel's life, and I don't mean to make too much of it, but it's as true a portrait as I could draw of my relationship with him. But again, he's a character. He's somebody who could rise above all circumstances. In this book, in The Colonel and the King, first of all, the degree of energy, the degree of creativity, the degree of inventiveness, the degree of resourcefulness that he puts into every single event, which any Elvis fan will know and many of the general public will know, that the story doesn't change. You know, Elvis is on Ed Sullivan. Elvis is signed by RCA. But what goes into it on, it's like a view from the other side of the mirror. What goes into it on Colonel's part, all the things behind the scenes and this indefatigable commitment on Colonel's part to doing everything he can to protect both the interests and the vision of his artist. His entire, from the very beginning, you can read letter after letter where he makes the explicit point that his artist knows what he wants. His artist has a clear vision of what he wants to do musically. Colonel has nothing to do with that side of it, but he will defend to the death his artist's choices and ability to do exactly what he wants in terms of his artistic vision. So that was one side. But the other side of it, which I alluded to a moment ago for keeping this in sequence, is that when Elvis, the book end, not, it doesn't end differently, but it goes in an entirely different direction than I anticipated, which, you know, if we have any authors out there, and I'm sure we do, everybody knows you don't want to write a book by the numbers. You know, you don't want it. It's like coloring by numbers. You don't want to just fill in the blanks or go to the place you intended to go all along. You want to explore, and you're very likely to end up someplace unexpected. In this case, the story for 10 years is one. It's almost like Elvis's, like Last Train to Memphis, Elvis's unalloyed triumphs. And there is friction that develops between Elvis and Colonel, but it's of no, it isn't of very great significance. From the time that Elvis goes to Las Vegas in 69, this is the part that I never imagined. Colonel becomes a full-out gambling addict. And so in a sense, the story becomes, and this is not the whole story, the story, Colonel was a life force. He is somebody that I wish we had in the room right now because he would, I know I'm just wandering all over the place. Colonel would just liven things up. He might stop me, but he would tell a joke. He would, you know, engage the audience. He would engage you. He was an astonishing person, a person of astonishing just resourcefulness, inventiveness, and vitality. But, and again, so many stories don't have an explanation. Once Elvis started playing Las Vegas, the problem emerged with Colonel. He became a full-on gambling addict. And again, this is nothing I would have the temerity to write, just saying, oh, I think this is what happened. It isn't what I thought happened. In fact, what I thought, and you can look at this in Careless Love, was that Colonel could lose $1 million. And as it turned out, I don't think he ever lost more than $800,000 in a single, you know, at the roulette wheel at a single time. Maybe he lost $1 million, but I only came up with $800,000. But he could lose, in my previous view, he could lose $800,000 at the roulette table and walk away and shrug his shoulders and so what? It didn't make any difference. And to a degree, that's true in the sense that neither Colonel nor Elvis cared the least bit about money. Again, it's a funny thing to say, but neither one of them had any interest in accumulating money or an estate. Elvis gave his money away. Colonel gambled his money away and gambled it away on games of chance that he could never win. I can't explain it. Maybe you've done an advanced study on this subject, but Loanne Parker, Colonel's widow, described to me. I mean, she worked for him from almost from the time she met him and long before they got married. She was on every tour that Elvis did in the 70s. She described how the pressure, well, she said it both before and after every tour. Colonel would become so wrought up. And this, I don't know, I don't think this is an explanation, but it's just a description that he would spend as much as 3 days, usually after the tour was over, 3 days in the casino at a time without ever coming back to the room. And when he came back, he was wrecked and was, you know, unable to do anything for the next couple of days. And she said to me, I wish I could convey what a kind and devoted person she was. And I can only imagine how difficult this was. But she said to me, there's no other way to describe it than he was a gambling addict. And Luann said, you know, told me, she said, I said to him at one point, you care more about the gambling than you do about me. I feel like we should just go back. We should just go back to our relationship being a strictly business one. But the picture that this event, that this eventually caused to come into focus was you have Elvis, who was addicted to his pharmaceuticals, to his prescribed medications, and you have Colonel, who's addicted to gambling, and neither one of them can address the other's problem for fear that their accusation will come right back at them. And again, it wasn't something, so it's really, it's a kind of a linked tragedy, which I had not fully, maybe I'm dumb. Maybe every listener is going to say, how could you miss that? Yeah. And it doesn't make Colonel into a bad person. It didn't change the way either one of them behaved. There was no selling out. Elvis, Colonel made deals that brought in untold amounts of money. And Elvis spent even more. If he made $10 million, then he was making an astonishing amount of money. If he made $8 million, he spent $12 million. And one of Colonel's challenges as a manager, and this is borne out over and over again by imploring letters from Elvis's father, Vernon, saying, we're on the verge of losing Graceland. We're not able to pay. We're not going to be able to pay our taxes. You have to come up with money. And Colonel always did. He always came up with a new deal from RCA, primarily, or from the touring, but it stemmed from Elvis's spending. But again, I don't think there's any blame involved, but that's just what the situation was.
It does answer the question about why the Colonel did not do anything about Elvis's life-threatening addiction to drugs.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the other thing that answers that question is, and again, I know you don't enter the conversation. You're a wonderful interviewer who, you know, gives encouraging expressions like, go on, you know, reveal yourself to me. But I don't know if you've ever been involved in an intervention. I haven't really, although I've certainly been party to interventions. I've never seen one that fully worked, and they're certainly not easy. And I think the thing to understand with Elvis's world, there are two things to understand. One is that everyone around him cared about him, and virtually everyone, from Vernon and Colonel to many of the guys around Elvis, made their best effort to intervene, if you want to think of the word loosely, to give Elvis advice, to try to limit his, right down to Dr. Nick, who was the only doctor Elvis had. He's been pilloried, but he's the only doctor Elvis had who made any attempt to limit Elvis's intake and gave him, drugs, which are not the drugs themselves.
Placebo.
Placebos. Gave him placebos in an attempt to limit his intake. But in addition to everyone caring about him, in addition to many of them, most of them, making some attempts, the other thing you have to understand is every single one of them worked for him, including his father. And he said on more than one occasion, if you don't like it, there's the door. And every one of them knew that. So I don't know what, but I'll tell you one story with Colonel's addiction is that his longtime aide, Tom Diskin, who went back with him, again, the same length of time as Al DeVore, went back with him. Tom Diskin, who went back with him to 1951 or 52, when Tom Diskin's sisters, the Dickens, who sang as the Dickens sisters, went out on an Eddie Arnold tour, and Tom, being a good brother, he was a very good brother, accompanied them on tour. Tom Diskin approached Colonel in, I think, around 72, 73, and tried to intervene with Colonel. We're talking about Colonel now. And Colonel said, without any hesitation, get out of my sight, stop talking, you know, be gone. Let me just... And Colonel did not hesitate and banished Tom Diskin from his sight. And Al DeVoren, who had employed Tom Diskin when he went to work for Eddie Arnold, for Colonel, tried to intervene for Tom Diskin and said, you know, Tommy is just saying this because he loves you. And Colonel said to Al DeVoren, who was a very jolly fellow, he was the guy who said, you know, Elvis has left the building. He was a great guy. But Colonel said to him, get out of my sight. And Freddie Beanstalk told the same story. So, I mean, that's not the story of Colonel confronting Elvis, but it's the story of how difficult it is to confront anyone about their addiction.
We're talking with Peter Guralnick, and he has a brand new book, and it's called The Colonel and the King, Tom Parker, Elvis Presley, and the Partnership That Rocked the World. I love music, and I know you do. And I love pop music. And one of my favorite performers is Gene Austin. I just love Gene Austin. I love his. Of course, I love My Blue Heaven. It's a great record. But I love Carolina Moon. And I mean, he made some great, great records. And
really great, and records that became standards.
And he shows up early in your story. What was their relationship?
Well, Colonel managed. I mean, this is a little known fact, not because it's hidden, but just because people don't think of it this way. Basically, he managed four superstars, and Eddie Arnold was almost as great a superstar as Elvis. He followed Gene Austin, but Colonel had left the carnival circuit and was doing small promotions for a variety, for the Mas Brothers, for the Mas Brothers department store in Tampa, if that's the correct pronunciation. He would be Santa Claus at Christmas time. He would provide pony rides to kids who came in. He would get the ponies from his friends at the circus and the carnival. He worked for the Park Theater. I can't detail what he did, but he was basically, he was a person of great charm, great determination, and he was a promotion man. He was like an advertising man, but he put on promotions and enjoyed that. And Gene Austin had fallen on hard times by the time that he met Colonel, and he came to town. He came to Tampa with a movie that he had financed, at least in part himself, that was not being released in a conventional way by a studio, and he went around with that movie. This is, I think, around 38 or so. Do you know the date?
No, but that sounds right.
This was around 38, I believe. 38, and then, let me just stop there. This was around 38.
Okay.
And Gene Austin came to town with his movie and would do a stage show in between showings of the movie. Mm. And that's how it was advertised. And Colonel was working, and he was booked into the Park Theater. And Colonel, who was doing work there, met Gene Austin, was taken by his talent, and said, you know, if you ever need a manager, I'm available, and cited his previous experience, maybe exaggerated slightly his previous experience with various carnivals and circuses, and where he had been an advanced man, but maybe had not occupied quite as so exalted a position as he sold to Gene Austin. Well, Gene Austin said, well, I have a manager. And he went out with his manager, and the harsh words were spoken. money was lost, and the show broke down. And Gene Austin, I don't know if he wired him or called Tom Parker. He was not a colonel then. contacted Tom Parker and said, I'm in Atlanta. The show is broken down. I could use you. This is, I think, in about August of 38. And Colonel and his wife, Marie, first wife Marie, set out on the spot and joined the Gene Austin show. And I can't remember the name of it. No, it would be like a name like Hell's a Pop. I mean, great stars. He was a headliner for this show, which changed names a number of times, but I should remember, but I apologize. I don't. And Colonel just turned the business around. And by the end of that, you know, that season, Gene Austin's show was doing well. But unfortunately, either his previous partner or a previous business associate sued, and the IRS sued. And so once again, he was out of money. He went off to make money in Hollywood and sent Colonel back to his hometown in Texas to wait for the next season, which Colonel did, and made good use of his time and kept the troupe together for the most part. And they went out in 39 and he did the same thing. He basically righted a sinking ship. But it's hard to fight the IRS. It's hard to fight bankruptcies that have already taken place. And in the end, Gene Austin had to shut down the show. Colonel went back to Tampa, and then he became head of the Humane Society in Tampa, which was probably the best job he ever had. He loved animals. He was dedicated and devoted to animals, and that he held that job for 2 years, but kept on doing his promotions. And that was the way he found his way to doing these country promotions. That led to his finally embracing that aspect of show business, which is the music business.
Well, I think it's interesting that I don't know about Hank Snow, but the other three all recorded for RCA. Did Hank Snow?
Yeah, Hank Snow too.
Yeah, so RCA was his label all along.
RCA was always his label, but I don't think the Gene Austin part it played into it because I don't know if Gene Austin was even on a label by the time Colonel met him. In any case, he didn't have that contact. But once Gene Austin was 38 and 39, Eddie Arnold was, I think, was 44 on for the next 10 years. And that was all RCA. And that was the contact that he cultivated for Elvis. And Eddie Arnold's career in that 10-year period represented a kind of stardom that nobody else in country music had previously achieved. And nobody, ever to this day, no one has surpassed it. He had the number one record on the country charts, I think, for 53 weeks in a row during that time period. And again, in terms of the deals Colonel made and the way in which he advanced Eddie Arnold's career and the way in which he defended Eddie Arnold's artistic choices, it's very similar and very parallel to Elvis.
You know, I didn't always know things about musicians when I was listening to Elvis when I was a kid. And I would hear Elvis Presley songs that struck me as being, oh, I love that one. I love that one. And two of his that I loved was his recording of You Don't Know Me and his recording of I'm Moving On. And I didn't realize until later, well, that's a Eddie Arnold song and that's a Hank Snow song.
Yeah, no, I think that Elvis was very affected by all kinds of music. I think one of the mistakes that people make in thinking about Elvis's music, and I'm going to plead guilty here, and I'll explain why, is that they think of him as being one particular thing, being dedicated to one particular kind of music or another. It just wasn't the case. The way I discovered Elvis was through blues. I mean, I had fallen into blues when I was 15, 16 years old. I was just totally swept away. I mean, it just grabbed me, and I'd never heard anything like it before. And I was listening to Lightnin' Hopkins and Howlin' Wolf and Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry and Big Bill Broomsey and everything. Yeah. I mean, everything I could get my hands on. And it was really only when Elvis was in the Army, I think in 1959, and at Colonel's instigation, and there's a reason for this, but it doesn't much matter. But RCA reissued for the first time, put some of his son sides, like That's All Right and Mystery Train, on an LP. And that was the first I heard of them. And I knew the originals. I mean, it wasn't that I thought, I mean, I knew the Arthur Crudup song. I knew Little Junior Parker Mystery Train. I knew the Arthur Crudup That's All Right. So it wasn't as if I was looking for a substitute. But when I heard Elvis, I thought, oh my God, he's a blues singer. He's a great blues singer. He's not better than the other blues singers, but he's great. And he's not taking their place. He's taking his place beside them. Anyway, that was my error was not, I wasn't wrong about that, but every time he sang anything that wasn't a blues from that time on, I thought, oh, well, look at him, he's selling out. Why isn't he singing blues? But that was not his, and so that was not his exclusive domain. I mean, he loved gospel music. He loved Italian aria. And he really ambitiously took on every type of music. But, you know, when he sang Moving On by Hank Snow, it was a tribute to a great artist with whom he had worked at the very beginning of his career. That's who Colonel put him with right within weeks of first meeting him in Elvis in 1955. He put him on the bill with Hank Snow, whom he was managing at the time. And You Don't Know Me is such a classic song by Eddie Arnold. So again, I think Elvis had a very high regard for Eddie Arnold as well, and he sang the song because it moved him. But it's worth noting that Gene Austin, I haven't met a lot of interviewers who have said,
you know, Gene Austin.
Gene Austin is one of my favorite, you know, artists. And I mean, I've watched all these clips of Gene Austin since I, you know, in the course of writing this book. And I said, wow, his piano playing was kind of like a cross between Chico Marx and Jerry Lee Lewis. I mean, it's so entertaining. And he sang in that fashion of the day of the 20s. I mean, My Blue Heaven was the biggest single hit that ever was until White Christmas by Bing Crosby.
And he recorded that in 26 or 27, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just a number one hit. It was an all-time number one hit.
Yeah.
But as he said of his nephew, who was a country singer, whose name I'm forgetting, he said, you know, they all sing with falsetto, but my falsetto has balls.
Well, I can see that. In some ways, I think the way you're describing Elvis is like Bing Crosby. Bing Crosby recorded, I mean, people think of Bing Crosby as one thing, but Bing Crosby recorded jazz and pop and Hawaiian music and country music. And he was, you know, he had a broad range also, and he was really interested in the authentic music that he was doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good comparison. I think if Colonel had discovered Bing Crosby, he would have. I mean, the point about Colonel was he wasn't looking for an everyday artist. In the case of Gene Austin, the opportunity was there for Colonel and for Gene Austin. But if he had not believed in Gene Austin's artistry, he didn't have to believe in the music. It's like you say, well, he managed, Elvis Presley. So he must have loved rock and roll, or he didn't like rock and roll. So it had nothing to do with rock and roll. It had to do with his artist, who he saw as having unlimited potential. And in Elvis's case, I don't think he felt that Elvis was the greatest. He expresses this in the letters again and again, that Elvis is the greatest artist he had ever met. It wouldn't matter what kind of music it was. He envisioned a movie in which Elvis would sing authentic Hawaiian music, which he loved. But it really made no difference. And I think that the same with Eddie Arnold, who sang what was in the 40s, sang what was called heart music. But he reached people in a way, not the only person. Hank Williams reached people in a similar way with a very different sound. But with Eddie Arnold, he reached his audience in a way that was similar to the way that Elvis would come to reach them. Elvis may have gone beyond that. But Eddie Arnold was not some everyday singer. He was someone whose talent and whose vision Colonel Parker believed. First, Tom Parker, initially.
That's right. He wasn't a colonel yet. But let me ask you a question, because now you've raised an issue that I'm curious about. So you said in the book, and you just now, that Colonel respected Elvis as the arbiter of music. Elvis should choose his own songs. He should choose who should play on those songs, how those songs should be recorded, although he tried to influence him with regard to publishing a little. But it was Elvis's deal. But what about with the movies? So, like, a couple of times, Colonel lays out plots, you know, of ideas he has for movies, which sound like pretty interesting movies. But, you know, if you look at Elvis's movie career, I think he made 31 movies. King Creole shows us this direction that he could have gone cinematically, and Follow That Dream is another direction he could have gone.
That's true. Not a lot of people say that, but I think that's true. It's a different direction.
Yeah.
Yes.
But Kissin' Cousins, you know, seems to have won the day. Why doesn't the Colonel influence the films more, or did he, or who? Why did Elvis make so many terrible movies?
You know, like so many questions and answers, the answers are not simple.
Yeah.
If you look at the letters in the book, and I tried to make the letters a running narrative, that a narrative that ran parallel and extended the story that's being told in the biography. Over and over again, Colonel is saying to these studios, this is prior to Elvis going to the Army. You know, his last movie was King Creole in 1958, just before he went into the Army. And Colonel is saying, Elvis wants straight dramatic roles. Elvis wants to, you know, be like James Dean, like Marlon Brando. Montgomery Clift would be mentioned on occasion too. Elvis wants challenges. We've now made three musicals in a row, he said, at the end of 57. And you know, two of them were very good. I mean, the thing about Love Me Tender was Elvis had not been, he'd even been in so much as a high school play. He had had no drama, and you can watch him. He learned the entire script by heart. I think Mildred Dunnett, who was a co-star in that, talked about this. He knew every line, and you can watch in his scenes. He knows his lines, but he's waiting for the other actor to finish their lines. He's eagerly wants to jump into it. By the time of King Creole, which is Loving You, I think, was a big improvement. J.L.S. Wright was an improvement for that. By the time of King Creole, he's actually in the moment. He's acting in the manner that he, Tom Diskin, Colonel's chief associate, sent Elvis a book on the Stanislavski method. That's what Elvis was interested in. I don't know whether Elvis would have said, yes, that's Stanislavski. That's Stanislavski. He's a cool cat. You know? I mean, I don't mean to mention me. I mean, I don't know to what extent, but it was, that's what it was, using his own experience, his own memories to evoke the character's experience. And in King Creole, he achieves it. Colonel writes again and again, Elvis wants straight dramatic roles. He doesn't want to repeat himself. Elvis gets out of the army. He gets two, not Follow That Dream is another. That's a comedy kind of strand.
One of the only musicals he ever made, right? I mean, his music in all of his movies, but
well, they're not
Follow That Dream is Wild, a musical. In
Wild in the Country and in Flaming Star, there is virtually no music. But what I'm saying about
Follow That Dream is it's a musical in that all the characters sing, the story is furthered by songs, as opposed to Elvis plays a guy who plays a guitar and sings.
But no, I think that's a good point. And also, he plays a character in which he is
he's Jethro. Playing.
I'm sorry, what?
He's Jethro in that movie.
Yeah, he's Jethro, yeah. And he's playing for the comedy, and he's consciously playing for it, and I think it's... And Colonel was very upset, for example, that the studio did not promote the movie better. They were promoting it, if I'm not misremembering, they were promoting it as it's another Elvis Presley movie. He says, you seem to think, he said to the studio, and he said this on more than one occasion, that you seem to think that if you say it's another Elvis Presley movie, that's going to sell tickets. That's not, this is a particular movie. You should be marketing it in a particular way to appeal to the family audiences that would enjoy this and the, But the point is that in that same time, immediately getting out of the army in 60 and going into 61, he did do two straight dramatic pictures, Flaming Star and Wild in the Country. And again, everybody has a different, you know, we all have different aesthetics. We all have different takes. We all have different tastes. I'll just say what my feeling is, aside from the fact that neither was a very good movie, Elvis did not give a very good performance in either one. I'm saying, now there may be people out there who say, how could he say that? That's okay. We all have our differences. And I think there are reasons for that. I think one of the reasons may have been that he was introduced to amphetamines in the army at the PX, like so many people. And then also at a time when people like President Kennedy were getting their amphetamine shots from Dr. Feelgood, a famous physician in New York City. I mean, it was seen as a good thing, Elvis. But it tends to make you rush your lines, I think. And I talked to a doctor I knew named John Morgan. It was Dr. John, who was his expertise, was pharmacology, who suggested that might be the case. Who knows? But so neither movie was very good. That wasn't the worst part of it, though. The worst part was in 61, Elvis made Blue Hawaii. And I'm not taking anything away from Blue Hawaii. That may be everybody's favorite picture. It made more money than any other picture that you know, Elvis ever made. And it became the template for all of the pictures that followed because of its success. But there's one other element. I'm going to try to rush through this. In 1964, Elvis met Larry Geller, who came into his life as a hairdresser. And I'm not trying to dismiss Larry Geller. Larry Geller was a student of, let's say, New Age spirit, New Age religion, spiritus. He made his special. He was dedicated to spiritual studies. Ever since his mother's death in 1958, Elvis had not only been emotionally devastated, he was just thrown into a complete turmoil about what was I set on earth for? Why was I given this success? My mother was going to be taken away from me. He was devastated, but also, and he was looking for answers. And when Larry Geller came in, he embarked on and it had nothing to do with Larry Geller, it was what Elvis wanted, but he embarked on a period of spiritual studies that went from 1964 for the next 2 or 3 years anyway. I mean, it continued all of his life, but it absorbed him totally. During that time period, from 64 until mid-66, Elvis never entered the recording studio except to make the sound, to record the soundtrack to his movies. This is the thing that has moved him from the time he was 2 years old, music. It's not only a spiritual element, it's everything to him. And yet, all that he wanted to do during that period of time was he wanted to make the movies. He wanted to make as much money as he could from the movies, which Colonel delivered. He wanted to make the movies as quickly as possible, and he wanted to head home for Memphis, for Graceland, which he loved, and pursue his spiritual studies. And so not a single note was recorded for almost 2.5 years until Colonel finally figured a way out of that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But also, I think if you look at King Creole, that was directed by Michael Curtiz, who directed Casablanca and many, many other films. And one of the things, one of the areas of expertise that Michael Curtiz has is to bring great performances from singers. That is, he discovered Doris Day and made her a movie star. He worked with Bing Crosby. He directed Frank Sinatra. He directed all of the great singers.
Right, right.
Elvis needed a really good director to pull a performance from him, and I don't think he ever got another. I mean, he worked with Don Siegel on one of those, right?
But, well, I was going to say, Don Siegel, the Flaming Star, was certainly a notable director.
A notable, and I think he got better. I think he made better movies, certainly, after that one. But, mm-hmm. But maybe, you know, if Elvis had, right, the army is such a, that comes at such a terrible time in Elvis. I mean, it's the worst thing that could have happened, I think, in terms of Elvis's film career. Maybe.
Well, it was the worst thing that could have happened in terms of Elvis's life.
Yeah. Right.
It essentially confirmed all the pessimism and the sense of hopelessness that he fell into with his mother's death. And there's a letter, again, I refer to the letters because they're in the book, but there's a letter from his father, Vernon, to Colonel shortly after they arrive in Germany in late 58, saying, "We're just at a loss. Elvis is devastated. I don't know what to do. You've got to help us out." And what Colonel did under those circumstances, which is the same thing he did throughout Elvis's life. I mean, you could say that this, in a sense, was, it's either Colonel's limitation or his strength. He delivered a deal. Which to Elvis, or a series of deals, almost immediately following Vernon's letters, which set up, films over the next 2 or 3 years, which would, as he wrote to Elvis, and he wrote to Elvis, I would say, 2 or 3 times a week. He called him when he didn't write to him. I mean, it was just an unbelievable correspondence to try to raise Elvis's spirits. But he wrote to Elvis, he says, "Your career is now in better shape when you get out of the army than it was before you went in." And that was really the best way that Colonel knew to comfort Elvis. And let me go back for 1 second to, it'll probably be more, I got to confess, it'll probably be more.
In 1 second.
But in 1965, when Elvis was in the middle of this period of not recording, you know, it was two years now of not recording anything but soundtrack, Colonel didn't know how to get him back into the studio. He was not fulfilling his contractual obligations to RCA. Colonel was nothing if not literal in his belief that you lived up to your obligations. You lived up to your contracts. You lived up to your handshake. Colonel never fell down on any deal that he made. You could go to the bank on his handshake. Anyway, so Elvis's record sales in 1965 had fallen by 40% from what they had been in 1960. Colonel made a deal with RCA that would bring in $2.1 million over the next 7 years, and a substantial improvement over the guarantees that he had. But at the heart of that contract, and I don't think everybody would have noticed this at the time, was that Elvis would record a gospel album. And I don't think there's any question that the reason Colonel had that at the heart of the contract was because he felt that this was the thing that would motivate Elvis to return to the studio. And when he brought Elvis the news of the deal, and Elvis was quite voluble in acknowledging the great snowman's deal, what he called the Colonel sometimes. And, you know, you can't sneeze at $2.1 million. And when Colonel said, and here's, you will owe them a gospel album, Elvis began rehearsing for that recording of that album with Red West and Charlie Hodge, and rehearsing almost constantly, and then went into the studio in the spring of 66 and recorded How Great Thou Art, along with a lot of other music, which was the beginning of his second or third renaissance as an artist. This period would go from How Great Thou Art to a succession of singles in 67, which included You Don't Know Me, you know, that you mentioned.
Yeah, I love that.
And then it went to the 68 special, the 1969 recording sessions with Chips Moman and American, which are just an astonishing, and ultimately to Las Vegas, where Elvis wanted to introduce all the strands of music that had influenced him in a completely new context. And I'm not sure he succeeded, but the point is, these were vast artistic, all of these things represented vast artistic ambition, but they all started with a contract.
It's fascinating, truly. Do you think that Colonel Parker was always thinking of Elvis, or how much of it was his? I mean, he always profited greatly from every deal, right? I mean,
he profited 25%.
And he was sued at one time.
Like many managers.
Right.
Up until 1967, 25% was a going rate. I mean, it was, for instance, the going rate for his mentor, J.L. Frank, the one person he ever cited as his mentor in the business, who basically introduced him first to Ernest Tubb, to Roy Acuff, then to Ernest Tubb, then to Eddie Arnold.
And I learned in your book, though, that after Elvis's death, he was sued. There was a contentious relationship with Presley's estate.
Not with the estate.
No.
I don't want to leave the thought that he took only 25%. He took only 25% basically until 1967. In 1967, he effected a semi-divorce between Elvis and Larry Geller, who remained in the picture for a long time after. I'm not trying to paint Larry Geller as a villain, but that's, and he also was talking to a number of his friends and associates. I mean, I talked to so many of Colonel's business associates, all of whom admired him enormously and admired his integrity, most of all. But he spoke of how difficult it was becoming to manage Elvis. And he used either that's the reason or that's the rationalization for his redefining the relationship somewhat in 67. So that while he would continue to take 25% on, you know, the RCA, on the $2.1 million deal and on everything, on the publishing, on the movie deals, he would take, they would become, oh God, I'm going to forget the name, where this, they would enter into a joint venture on deals that Colonel made that were beyond the contracted amounts. So that, let's say the deal with RCA was for $2 million, just for the sake of argument. And then he got a bonus payment, or he did this. And on those bonus payments, it became 50-50. And this was recast again in 73, when truly, as you can see from the book, both from the biography and from the letters that went back and forth in at the end of August, the beginning of September of 73, where basically Elvis and Colonel fired each other. Things had really reached a stage where Colonel felt, and again, you can call it rationalization or reasoning, this was taking far, far more of anybody's effort to get more and more money for Elvis to make up for the money that Elvis was spending. And so at that point, they entered into what amounted to a joint venture on most things, which was a 50-50 split on most things, but not by any means all, not on publishing, not on the movies that have been made, not on the previous deals, and not even on touring, which went 2/3, 1/3 for Elvis shortly thereafter, but up until then was still 25%. So it's sort of a more complicated thing, but Colonel made good money. But I don't think, but the entire, all of his negotiating was intended to be in Elvis's interests. He was not looking to do it for free. he believed in his own worth, but I don't think there's a single deal. And for example, sometimes people would say, oh, well, because he had all these gambling debts, he was selling Elvis short in Las Vegas. Elvis was making more money than anybody else in Las Vegas. And Baron Hilton, who was running the Hilton in Las Vegas, and I'm not sure what his position was in the overall company, it was pretty high, was apologizing to Colonel because he couldn't pay as much as they could make on the road, and he appreciated Elvis's loyalty to him. But he was making, at that point, it started at $1 million for 8 weeks, for 2 4-week periods, and it probably went up to 1.3 million, or I don't really remember what the top was, but it was more money than anybody else was making. And Colonel was not compromising Elvis's earning ability, either on the road or in Las Vegas or in any other way, to satisfy his own needs or interests.
Peter Guralnick, I have so many more questions, and I have all these. I didn't even get to any of the questions, in fact, that I wrote down.
that's my fault, you know. I apologize.
I think it's my fault. But so I'm hoping that you'll come back and talk some more really soon. The new book is called The Colonel and the King, Tom Parker, Elvis Presley, and the Partnership That Rocked the World. Peter Guralnick, thanks so much for talking with us, and please come back.
Thanks. You know I'll come back. I always come back. But next time I'll try to be more disciplined.
No, I don't want that. That wouldn't be as fun. Lissa Warren joins me now. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She teaches at Emerson College in Boston. She's active on X at Lissa_Warren. And she joins me here occasionally on From the Bookshelf. Lissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be with you.
It's always good to talk to you. And I know that you have a new book that you want to tell us about. So do tell.
It's called The Last Extinction, The Real Science Behind the Death of the Dinosaurs. It is by Dr. Goethe Keller, and it is published by Diversion Books, and it is available now. It was recently brought to press. So here's a question for you, Gary, to start this conversation off.
Yeah.
What do you think killed the dinosaurs? What caused the dinosaurs to become extinct?
Well, I think it was the Republicans.
Yes, it is easy to blame them for things. I understand that, but it wasn't, in fact, the Republicans that caused the dinosaurs to become extinct. We can blame them for a lot of things, but not that.
Well, of course, I think popular belief is that there was a meteor that struck the Earth and caused climate change to the degree that it eliminated them.
You are right. Everybody thinks that it is an asteroid that collided with the Earth and caused some sort of climate catastrophe, and that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs. And it turns out that that was actually not the case. It was not an asteroid. It was a volcanic eruption in India's Deccan Traps that released iridium from deep in the earth, and that iridium polluted the air so much that, now this is the sad part, Gary, yeah. The shells of the dinosaur eggs became exceptionally hard, and the little baby dinosaurs couldn't peck their way out, and they died. And that is what caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. So wow. It was this iridium from deep in the earth that was caused by the volcanic eruptions in India, not an asteroid crashing into Mexico, which is what they believed to be the case. Now, this book, The Last Extinction, is a memoir by the woman, and you know I love that it was a woman,
yeah.
who blew the asteroid theory to blitz. And that is Dr. Goethe Keller, who said, "It wasn't an asteroid. I have proof. I know what it was." Now, Goethe Keller was born into a life of poverty on a small farm in Switzerland. She was the sixth of a dozen children. And she was very much left to raise herself just because there were so many kids underfoot. She was told that her dreams of becoming a doctor, a medical doctor, were impossible. And she was never one to take no for an answer, so she embraced her love of science and defied the odds by completing her graduate studies in geology at Stanford, little school you might have heard of.
Yeah.
And she went on to become a professor at Princeton University. And she established herself as a major voice in her field. And she did all of that much to the dismay of her male colleagues, who intentionally derailed her work for years and years and years and took credit for her discoveries and chided her for not knowing her place. Her discoveries in sedimentary and fossil records proved that the dinosaurs were wiped out because of this eruption in India of a volcano. And her theory sparked what became known as the Dinosaur Wars. And it was a really contentious debate over what triggered the fifth mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous era. And that is 66 million years ago, if I'm doing my math right. Now, these people that disagreed with her and were so rude to her, she refers to them as the impactors because they believed in the asteroid impact theory. But boy, the name just kind of fit them, the impactors. And so the impactors went on to learn what happens when you pick a fight with a brilliant woman who is not afraid to challenge long-held beliefs. If you like science, if you like history, if you like stories of women in science, or just women who will not put up with any junk that people are putting their way, you will love this book. She is just phenomenal and unstoppable and so very her in this book. Her voice just leaps right off the page. I loved this one.
The Last Extinction, The Real Science Behind the Death of the Dinosaurs, Goethe Keller.
You got it. Goethe, not Greta. That's right.
Goethe, yeah. All right, Goethe. Fantastic. Well, Alyssa, thank you for being here on From the Bookshelf and telling us about this book that now I want to read.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.